Are you sure you want to stay here? It looks creepy.
But Savannah, this is the House of Mystery. Let's see, the brochure says true crime, conspiracy, alternate history, all rooms right here in the house.
I don't know, which room is ours?
Yes, this may be our room. Oh, well, sorry, ma'am. Obviously, this is not our room. Oh, here's our room. True crime.
You've now entered the House of Mystery on KYAH. Utah's Talk Authority with your hosts, Al Warren and Kev Thompson. Also, Julie Saville with the Paranormal Report. The True Crime Commentary by Stephen David Lampley and Dr. Joseph Usensky's Conspiracy Countdown.
Welcome you back to Stephen's True Crime Commentary. I am Stephen David Lampley, and I thank you for joining us again. You people are amazing. The kind comments and support that you've given me on my True Crime Commentary has been phenomenal. Please, if you would, share the commentary with your friends. Tell them to listen in, and I'd really appreciate that. The more listeners we have, the better. Thank you so much. Today we're going to begin our discussion on ballistics. There's going to be several parts to this, and this is the first part. Let's just get right into it. There are four stages of ballistics. The first stage is internal ballistics, or the ballistics that have to do with the firing of the weapon until the bullet exits the barrel. The next phase of ballistics is transitional. Transitional ballistics exists from the time the bullet exits the gun until all of the built-up pressure inside of the gun has subsided and equalized. The next phase of ballistics is external. External ballistics has to do with the ballistics involved from the time all the pressure is released until it strikes the target. Terminal ballistics is the last category, and terminal ballistics has to do with the ballistics involved of the bullet itself and the target. Alright, so today we're going to talk about internal. Matter of fact, today and the next episode, we're going to talk about internal because there's a lot of stuff that goes on inside that gun in a split second. Alright, as I said, internal ballistics has to do with everything that happens in the gun from the time the firing pin strikes the primer and sets in motion the combustion of the primer until the bullet has cleared the gun. There's a difference now. Also, I see this a lot. A lot of people think that a bullet is what they put in gun. And that's partially true, but let me explain. There's a difference between the bullet and the cartridge. All right? A cartridge consists of the casing, which is usually brass, the primer, the gunpowder, and the bullet that is stuck in the end of the casing. Now, that's a cartridge. The bullet is what comes out of the barrel. Okay, so when you put bullets in the gun, yeah, that's partially true, but you're putting so much more. You're putting a cartridge in with everything that you need to fire the bullet. All right. Now, when the firing pin strikes the primer, it sets in motion the combustion of the primer. Now, a primer is typically composed of three elements, antimony, barium, and lead. These are the signature elements of gunshot residue. Now, the primer typically is enclosed by a very, very thin sheet of aluminum, and the combustion in the primer quickly burns through the aluminum, and the fire then reaches the gunpowder, igniting it. Now, once the gunpowder is ignited, you're going to have a tremendous amount of pressure in that gun. We're talking about 30,000 to 40,000 pounds per square inch in that gun that you're holding. Now, this is what forces the bullet out of the gun at a rapid pace. Now, when the combustion begins, the pressure that's created by the firing starts to exit any opening in the gun it can find, any crevice, any hole. It doesn't all come out the end of the barrel, you understand? It takes any avenue it can find. Included in that combustion plume is primer and gunpowder residue, along with microscopic parts of the casing and even the gun barrel itself. Now, gunpowder is typically composed of nitrocellulose and other compounds containing nitrate or nitrogen. Now, other additives can include things such as stabilizers, plasticizers, flash inhibitors, coolants, moderants, surface lubricants, and even anti-wear compounds. But this is not necessarily what we're concerned about when we talk about gunshot residue. And we'll talk about this a little more later. Primer elements are typically easier to detect in residues as they do not get as hot as the gunpowder. Okay? Now, contrary to what people think, again, gunpowder is not what forensic investigators are interested in. Forensic investigators are interested in a triad combination of the three elements and the primer, antimony, barium, and lead. When the primer and gunpowder combust, it creates a super saturated cloud that includes a plethora of materials. As it exits the gun, this plume of smoke, per se, begins to cool, and some of the elements combine together as it cools as they fall from the air. Now, it is these three elements combining from the primer that forensics people are interested in. Some of these spherical shapes only contain antimony, some only barium, some contain a couple of them. They're not necessarily interested in the ones that contain one or two elements. They're looking for the spherical shapes in the gunpowder residue that contain all three of those. Now, let's talk a little bit about lands and grooves. When a gun is manufactured, it is milled, and the barrel of the gun is ground with grooves in a twisting pattern so that the bullet spins as it leaves the barrel. Now, why does the bullet need to spin? If you're a football fan or you know a quarterback, ask any quarterback, is a football more accurate if you just throw it stiff-armed, or is a football more accurate if it spins as it goes? And 100% of them should tell you it's more accurate if it spins. And so therefore, that's why a bullet needs to spin, because it keeps on track better and it's more accurate. Now, because the bullet is so very tight as it passes through the barrel, the indentions ground down, called the grooves, and the raised areas left, called the lands in the barrel, leave impressions on the bullet. Gun manufacturers vary on land and groove dimensions, and all of these are listed in a database for forensic examiners to search. The measurements of lands and grooves are called class evidence. It's what we call class evidence. Class evidence tells the manufacturer and the model of the gun. Class evidence does not tell us which gun. It gives us a basis to narrow down that we're looking for a certain model and a certain caliber of the gun, maybe even a certain year or a certain lot. Now, because guns are milled, there are imperfections on the metal surface caused by the milling process itself. Some of these imperfections may be visible with the eye, but most are not. Now, these imperfections, because of the tight fit of the bullet traveling through the barrel, also leave marks on the bullet. Now, these imperfections are called individual evidence. Individual evidence tells us which gun the bullet was fired from. If you'll look at the handout, for instance, that goes along with this, the bottom right photo, you'll see a arrow that points to the edge of the groove, and you can see the width of the groove. And inside the width of the groove, you'll see small striations in the groove. These are caused by little raised areas in the barrel. These little raised areas cause these indentions, because each handgun is different with its imperfections. It's like a fingerprint, and we can identify which gun or the individual gun that fired this bullet. Listen, our time is out. We're going to come back next week, or we're going to finish up internal ballistics. Listen, I want to invite you. We have a new program out called How to Catch Liars. It's a seminar format. It's about an hour to 2 hours in length, depending on what your needs are. And we're giving this throughout the country. What I seek to do is to help you understand how to catch liars, what to look for, what they do. In this seminar, we cover such things as global versus individual indicators, contractions, base shift. We'll talk about illusion and evasion. We'll discuss voice and tone and eye shift. And there'll be a lot more discussions. When you leave there, you'll have a better understanding of how to pick out a liar, how to tell when you're being lied to. If you are interested in learning more about this, just go to my website, StephenDavidLampley.com/catch-a-liar. Listen, it's been great. I've enjoyed being with you again. I'll see you again next time.
Stephen's True Crime Commentary is a production of Something Weird Media and West 53rd Productions. Music by JasonLampley.com.
Well, welcome back to the House of Mystery, and we're coming from KKNW Seattle. It's 11:50 a.m., and I'm Al Warren.
And I'm Kev Thompson.
And Stephen Lampley is here, too.
He's lurking about in the shadows.
Yeah. We're having a slow start here. That's all right. We're just back from the new year. And what are we doing here? Oh, actually, we're going to start with thanking the new stations that have joined and now playing us in Utah. We've got KYAH 540 AM at 4 p.m. Monday to Fridays. And now KVFX 98.3 FM. And they're going to be running at the same time. So we'll see if the new Utah listeners like us or not. We'll find out. Good mail calls. All right. So, except for Kevin. Yeah.
Yes. Yes, I'm the bad influence.
Yeah. And let's get into the weird laws of the day. Let's start out with that. What was the weirdest law of the day that we had? And that was probably the one in Australia, right? The you have to be a certified electrician to replace a light bulb.
But, you know, like I said before the show, that makes sense because they screw in backwards. Because they're south of the equator.
Okay. So
you don't believe me, flush a toilet.
Well, but does that mean that they need a special plumber?
No, you just stand in the toilet, you put the socket in, you flush the toilet, and as you turn, it turns the bulb in and you're good.
Okay. It's going to be an ugly day. now, we've got a great guest. Actually, the last year, we just rerun the show in a couple of her stations, and that was for the Hunting Hitler, and that was with Dr. Michael Simpson. And he's back again, and thank you for joining us on this crazy show.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be back.
Yeah. Well, it's
Are
not
you
over.
Sure?
Well, at this point, I'm really wondering if you're allowed to plunge your own toilet in Australia, or if you have to call a plumber.
That's
good point.
That's what I think. You know, some of these laws, but you know, it could be worse. You know, the British are even worse, right? So,
I think it's a conspiracy with the plumbers union.
Yeah, call Alex. Get him on the phone. I want to talk to you.
There's, I don't remember what state it is, but I was told once that there's a law still on the books that if you're going to drive a horseless carriage through an intersection, you must first step into the intersection and fire a rifle into the air.
Well, that's
make sure
on.
You're not going to run any horses over. Yeah. Well, it's still going on, but I don't think for the same reasons.
No, No.
That's here in Alabama, right, Steve?
Yeah.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
That's all they do in Alabama. They shoot up the Walmarts. Wow.
Well, we have to have a certified firearms instructor to fire that rifle, though.
That's true.
Okay. Okay. I'm into that. Well, okay. So now, Hunting Hitler is back. It's season
it is.
Three.
Yes, we are.
And
yes.
I just caught the first two last night. So I'm not all the way up to date. So what's the whole plan with the new season? Like, kind of, do you have a direction that you want to go in for this season different than the last one?
The way it's different in a couple of ways. First and foremost being the big momentum that we got off of season two was that we weren't really talking about it on the show for the viewers at home to see, but by the end of season two, we were really doing a lot of what we call asset mapping, which means we kept noticing these inner circle names of people that were directly associated with Adolf Hitler, people that he would trust. These names kept popping up geographically and temporally related to one another. With the momentum that we had coming off of season two, Bob being the extremely experienced analyst that he is with all of his years of experience running operations like this, he went out looking for some more expertise and brought Neda Bakos onto the team. And that is her area of expertise, actually, is asset mapping. She has been very involved in the global war on terror in helping us track down nefarious individuals such as Osama bin Laden himself. So this is right in her wheelhouse. So we couldn't ask for a better person in the Situation Room to be helping us in the field with the asset mapping aspect of it. So that, and combined with the fact that, and I think I talked about this with you guys last season, there's this weird phenomenon that actually in between seasons, when seasons are already wrapped, we are inundated with new information. It's almost like, I remember thinking last season, the amount of information that I got through social media contacts, emails and everything else, I'm like, wow, I wish we could go back and just tack on another three episodes with all this new information. Well, that wasn't just for me. That was for the whole team. So a lot of the information that you're seeing, again, these came from people that saw the show and said, hey, I know somebody that has information from that. And also, as we continue to progress, more and more things have become declassified. And, you know, this started in the original first season with basically a cache of FBI documents that were declassified. Now this year, we have, aside from the worldwide investigation that this has become, literally getting documents from all over the world, we have a new cache of declassified CIA documents that came out in kind of two spurts, as it were. We had already started the season investigative leg. And then, of course, the big release that everybody was aware of that happened fairly recently was the one with the JFK documents, which kind of inadvertently had some stuff that dovetailed into our investigation as well.
It's pretty unusual how they tie together. What's kind of the most of the information that you're getting on off season? What is most of it about? Like, what's it directed to? When people contact you, are they saying like they knew where Hitler was, or what seems to be the direction that people give you?
I've gotten everything. I've gotten everything that runs the gamut from my great uncle or my grandfather worked in X location. And he was the driver for someone we later determined to be this person, you know, a known Nazi that was fleeing after the Third Reich. We get a lot of information like that. And we also get a little bit of the crazier stuff. I did get contacted by somebody who basically told me they were a genetically engineered Nazi super child, and they had been asked to keep it a secret their entire life. But they had, as a child, they were visited at childhood birthdays by Mengele and by other individuals. Sounded a lot like some deleted scenes from the movie Boys from Brazil.
Yeah,
obviously,
I started to say that person
didn't get a lot of credence.
You know, I'm sorry about that. That was Kevin. You know, I know he did that. I told him not to call you, but, you know, I can't control him.
Mike, listen, how much of that information that you get is good information that you can use?
I'd have to say just from the information that I see that kind of personally goes through me, 5-10% at the outside, but probably more like 5%.
Okay.
Yeah, it's there's a lot of it is, hey, people saying, I get a lot of, hey, I've done my own research. And by done their own research, they've spent a lot of time Googling things.
Yeah.
And they really haven't come up with anything that's a new theory. A lot of times they've come up with stuff that we discarded a long time ago. We've had people pop up claiming to be junior officers on the U-boat that was never accounted for. That are pretty easily discredited. There's a lot of fake Elvis memorabilia out there. It's very similar with this investigation. There's a lot of people that have gotten a lot of free drinks over the years, telling some bogus stories about maybe meeting Hitler or being in proximity to some escaping Nazis. And I mean, we have to run down just about every lead, but a lot of them end up, you can discredit them fairly rapidly with nothing more than just some superficial investigation.
Now, who does these investigations in order to filter that information that's useful or not useful?
Most of that is done by Bob and by Nada and by some people that you don't see behind the scenes that we have making a lot of phone calls, actually traveling places and kind of talking to people in advance, saving us a little bit of the legwork. But everybody on the show, you know, everybody is legitimately a part of the investigation. That's there are many directions that we took this year that were. I credit James Holland with a lot of what you're going to see in some of the upcoming episodes, because this is all the research that he did. In about two or three episodes, you're going to get a little bit of a backstory on a nefarious individual who has almost a Nazi version of a Jason Bourne type story that's really interesting. That was all James. And, you know, and of course, early in the season, especially, you know, the whole framework of this investigation couldn't have been laid out if it wasn't for Gerard Williams and his incredible work that he's done in this, you know, really a lifetime of work by him to set the framework for this. So that, you know, that's kept us going all along. And Lenny DePaul, who I got to work with for the first time on camera this year, just has contacts all over the world. And, you know, Lenny can pick up a phone and verify an individual's identity or, you know, get some corroboration on somebody's story or get somebody discredited very quickly. And, of course, you know, Tim and I, worldwide military contacts. I spent almost a decade of my life in South America, so there are always people that I can turn to there and always assets that I can call on.
Yeah. You know, we've had Jill Gerard Williams on a few times from his book, you know, The Grey Wolf, and James Holmes. Mm-hmm. Really, really good. But that's pretty time consuming when you get a lot of these, you know, off the cuff sort of weird things that people tell you, you know, Hitler's on the moon and stuff like that.
Yeah, on the moon or in Antarctica or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. It's crazy. So have you already filmed the whole season now? Are you done filming?
Yeah, we're completely done. Season three is completely in the can. So
can you tell us the ending?
In fact,
as if the trailer doesn't.
Fade to black, roll credits.
I just wanted to add.
Yeah.
Do you find that a lot of people?
Go
ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, do you find a lot of people when you're out in these places and you're actually in a location and you're looking for Nazis, basically, or Hitler, or anything to do with that group? Do you find a lot of people to be kind of quiet? Or even confrontational, or to the point where they don't want to talk?
Absolutely. And it's a weird mixture because sometimes people will be put in contact with us, or we'll be put in contact with them. There'll be, you know, some initial reaching out, some initial back and forth, to kind of get an idea of what their story is going to be, you know, if it's worth us taking the time to go out there and you know, physically sit down with them face to face. You know, there has to be some vetting up front. And we try to do as much corroboration and verification as we can with, you know, through the channels and you know, make sure that this is not a person who's known for, you know, telling lies in the area or whatever it might be. But oftentimes when we actually show up and start to talk to them and we might have, you know, another person that has said, this person has told me this exact story about seeing, you know, whoever it might be, Eichmann, Mengele, Bormann, Hitler himself. They've told me this story 20 times. It's well known that they tell this story, or that, you know, their father was so-and-so, you know, with a name change or somebody who worked for them. But once they see the camera and we start to ask the questions, sometimes you see them pull in a little bit. It's like, now my face is going to be all over the world saying that me or my family is associated with this horrible thing. And they'll all of a sudden not want to say some things that they've probably said to somebody in the past. And that's a little bit of a challenge to draw that out. Other times people will claim to have a story and in the middle of speaking to them, you'll realize that maybe there's one nugget of truth in that story, but 75% of it is they're either looking through the lens of time and seeing it a little bit differently, or you know, trying to make the story a little bit better than it was, whatever it might be. Yeah, a little embellishment. And there have been several interviews that we've conducted that have not made it on camera. There was one in the second season where I got up and just walked out of a guy's house, and I said, this, number one, he's lying to me. Number two, I think he's a Nazi, and I'm not. We're done. I'm like, because this was after 2 hours of back and forth and me trying to get a certain bit of information, and literally every field interrogation technique I know not working. You know, from, you know, being very nice to him and complimenting him to just out and out being confrontational. I said, we're just not going to, you know, this guy's here because he wants to sell a book and really doesn't have any information that we don't already have. We're wasting our time. So it's challenging, you know, and there's days that we get back to where we're staying and I say, wow, you know, we talked to three people today that gave us nothing more than we didn't already have, nothing that's ever going to get seen on TV. And we just, you know, we flew all this way or maybe took a boat or whatever it might be to get here, and we basically wasted our time. But that's the nature of the investigation. You know, not every lead is going to be 100%. You know, this isn't – we're not walking in and scripting this, so they're not going to tell us exactly what we want to hear for the purpose of the cameras. So it's dicey. It really is.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, they're flying you all over, too, so that's okay. You're not paying for it. So.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's not too bad.
No. And but I was sort of getting at was, is there a fear still of Nazism? Like, are some of are some of them actually scared that if they speak out against, you know, any sort of Nazis, that something could happen to them now? Like, is there still that going on? Like, we, you know, you talk about the Fourth Reich and kind of the mm-hmm. idea of that's where it was going. So is there a Fourth Reich out there right now and Nazis that would do something to people if they were trying to speak out about it?
The impression that I've gotten from everyone that I've talked to is, you know, number one, yes, the fear is 100% still there. What is out there right now? I don't know if I would call it the Fourth Reich. The Fourth Reich is a theme that came up a little bit last season and comes up again this season. If this is Mike's opinion, this is nothing that's ever, you'll ever see on the show, but if I had to put a name on whatever might be out there right now, and I do think it's out there, I would actually call it more of a Fifth Reich. And I think it's unlike anything that we have kind of envisioned Nazism to be in the past. I think the people that are out there now that are espousing those same beliefs, that are willing to commit those same atrocities, I think they have learned to call themselves by different names, and I think they have learned to divorce themselves from the symbolism of the past. I don't think, you know, we see on the news there's obviously still a collection today of some very deranged, just completely disgusting individuals who will give a Nazi salute and will carry a Nazi flag. And I consider those people to be the lowest form of life out there breathing oxygen right now. But I think on par with them, there's another group who hardcore espouses those beliefs, but has learned to go completely underground and has learned to get to their objectives by much more by subterfuge, and they're not going to fly a swastika in your face. They're not going to give a Nazi salute where you can see it. They're going to call themselves by different names. They're going to codify the terms that they use, and they're going to use an entirely different manner to get there. This is not. I think the movement that's out there now that we would have to worry about more. And again, this is just Mike's opinion. Isn't a movement that would blitzkrieg. They're a movement that would creep in and assume positions of power and of positions of influence with the same ultimate objective of the Third Reich, but in a much more clandestine manner. And that's my opinion.
Mike, listen, and speaking for me as well, I know a lot of other people are probably having some question about how many are left that you would consider Hitler's upper echelon. How many of them are actually left that could still be still alive?
Yeah, I think just obviously because of time. And of course, the biggest joke that we get hit with all the time is, you know, why are you looking for Hitler? There's no way he made it to 128 years old. Well, that's, you know, obviously. I don't think there's anybody. Just because of time, there are no inner circle people mm-hmm. left. But that we have seen all the earmarks in every single season that the mantle was being passed, and you guys saw a lot of that at the end of last season when we went to Colonia Dignidad. That although, you know, they weren't flying a Nazi flag in that compound, and although they were calling it something different. A lot of these same the cycle of atrocities was continuing. They have passed the mantle off. The people that are out there now and still active are these people that got, you know, that got that the torch handed directly from Eichmann, Mengele, Bormann, Hitler directly, or are they one or two generations removed from them? I don't know. I think the latter is probably a little bit more likely. I think this is a point that we talked about actually on the team quite a bit this year, is at this point, it really doesn't matter that they're all dead. We are 100% sure that their ideology survived. We're 100% sure that the evil has survived and that the oppression continues. And at this point, the only way to ferret that out is to prove where these people fled to and where they went to ground and the connections that they made. Because now, as the next generation of these just absolute scum starts to emerge into a more public scene, we can then, again, with asset mapping, we can trace these back people back those same locations, to that those same small groups, wherever it is that they're ultimately coming out of, and we can make that connection. And we'll be able to figure out that, you know, there are people walking amongst us today, maybe even in public, that have connections to some of these individuals that went to ground in quiet back rooms. They shared their ideology. They planned for decades in the future. And then they ultimately died a coward's death and were buried in a nameless grave somewhere, but their ideology continues.
Okay, well, cool.
What was the biggest surprise that you learned in this season? Without giving away too much.
Biggest surprise that I learned in this season. Two big ones. I can tell you the finale of this season for me on the ground as an investigator, standing in the exact in the location that I was equally emotionally impactful. And expect the level of emotional gut punch that you felt in the finale of season two. You can expect all that and possibly more in the finale of season three. Things that I had just shocked me, just, you know, all the way to my bones, literally. The other thing that surprised me the most, and this was not on an emotional level, this was just a great kind of aha moment as an investigator, is you got a little glimpse of in the trailer for what's going to happen on the next episode. So in the next episode, I put on a dry suit and a scuba tank, and I go in the water to see exactly what secrets Lake Altesee is holding. And I can tell you, it's holding a lot of secrets. And you got a little glimpse of that in the trailer, yes. But it's definitely there. And physically seeing that proof and uncovering that proof with your own hands and seeing it with your own eyes and holding it in your hand, that's a feeling that I don't think could be compared with.
Yeah, Mike, let me go back to Stephen's question. You know, how many are out there? You know, we're probably looking about two generations down this time in our time now. What are they waiting for? What is their end game? I mean, do they have like annual meetings, and, you know, what are they waiting for?
I don't think they are waiting. I think they're doing what they're doing. I think they just have a much different plan. You know, if you look at, and James, you know, James being a historian, he can kind of expound on this much better than I can, but the Nazis in the Third Reich, late 30s, going into the 40s, it was all about expand or die for them. I mean, they really had to. They were a small country. They didn't have enough of their own resources. it's kind of funny because this term, just the other day I heard somebody use the term government jobs programs. And whenever I hear that term, I actually think of the government jobs programs of Nazi Germany, because that's how he, in a country that had no employment, he kind of created false employment with all this road work, building an autobahn they really couldn't afford, creating all these government jobs, but that was not sustainable. So in order to sustain all the people that Hitler put in uniform, because really he was giving them jobs by putting them in these German military uniforms, he had to then do something with that. He had to conquer lands. He had to take resources from other places. So there was a time factor there. There was a reason that the Nazis, they had to do it, and they had to do it quick. I don't think the movements that we're talking about today have the impetus to do that, because they're not talking about a post-World War I Germany that they're having to sustain the population and move quickly to gather natural resources. I think this is a movement that is willing to bide its time and work in the shadows and use all the resources of the 21st century, the internet and everything that it involves to gather resources, to do recruitment. And again, I think they do the recruitment under a totally different face. I don't think this is a website people go to with a swastika on the landing page and click for more information. I think this is, they're putting out feelers on an ideological level and bringing people into this ideological umbrella and saying, this is our ultimate goal. Get on board and be a part of this. And I don't think they're waiting for anything. I think they're doing it right now. I think they're gathering assets. I think they are putting people in positions of key influence. I think they are also looking to recruit people in positions of key influence and get money from people. And I'm 100% sure that there are people out there. There were people in Germany in the 1930s that were not bad people that maybe thought Hitler had the right idea. This was, before the evil was completely uncovered. And I think now it's easier for these people who were just, have those same terrible evil ideals to kind of keep that under wraps and maybe solicit funds or solicit support from people in positions of power and influence by using the right buzzwords, by saying, this is what we want. These are what our goals are. They put a much different, they packaged it in a much different, the poison in the bottle has been packaged in a very appealing package to this point for people that they don't realize what they're consuming. And because I do think they learned from the mistakes of the past. And, that's James and I, talked about length of it, talked about all the Third Reich was fraught with in retrospect, looking through the lens of history, it's like huge mistake, huge tactical mistake, huge strategic mistake, throwing all of your resources into this instead of this. I think the people out there now that espouse this ideology have learned from those mistakes.
Well, now let me go way out into left field here and get a little conspiratorial.
Sure.
Because we hear the same language thrown around the media today a lot. Mm-hmm. Nationalism or, anti-fascism or this is fascist or so-and-so's fascist or Trump's a Nazi. Well, no, Hillary's a Nazi. And you've got these groups that are acting very similar on both sides to, 1930s Germany. The Beer Hall Pusht. And do you think that maybe there really is a connection? If you say that this group is probably sitting back in the shadows and, utilizing modern resources such as the internet or, social networking, do you think it's possible that it really is happening?
Um, I I 100% think it's possible. I mean, if you look at the frustrated in the 1930s in post World War I Germany, the frustrated Germans who couldn't get a job.
The Treaty of Versailles was killing them.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, I mean they were beaten, they were broken, they were angry, and they were looking. One of the people that I talked to in the course of my investigation was somebody. He's not a Holocaust survivor himself, but has family members that were, and he's worked closely with the Mossad and with the Wiesenthal organization. And he told me, he said, you know, one thing that what we learned from history is the swastika. You know, the swastika is bad, and you know, the Nazi salute is bad, and anybody who gets up and praises Adolf Hitler, they're bad. But what we haven't learned is that the tactics are bad, that anyone with any ideology who tells you that person is to blame, that person is the problem, whether they're an ethnicity or a religion or an ideology, and says that person is to blame and therefore they are your enemy and therefore you are completely justified in whatever you do against them, that's wrong by any stretch of the imagination. And basically that was in the conversation I had with him. He said, you know, that any time someone comes up and they prop themselves up as a leader, and their first order of business is to point is to ally themselves with one group and then convince that group that another group is their enemy, that's a problem, and that's how it starts. That's how things like this start. And if you look at Germany in the 1930s. Most of the people that were on the streets marching and getting angry, I bet most of them hadn't even read Mein Kampf. They didn't 100% understand it. They knew they were angry, and they wanted to get out there. They wanted to get out there and do something about it. And I think in the age of the internet, a person that has this twisted ideology, it's even more simple for them to spin up groups like this and to get work them into a frenzy, and like you said, on both sides, work these people into a frenzy, convince other people that they're enemy, and say, you know, you got to go and clash against them. And I think you see these clashes happening in cities all across the country, between these Antifa groups and between these, you know, what they're calling the alt-right groups. And I think somewhere there's somebody watching this on TV, sipping a nice cold drink and just giggling to themselves, because this is all part of their plan, you know. And I don't know if they're allying themselves with one of these groups or maybe even both these groups. You know, there's a lot to be gained by pitting groups against each other and just kind of watching and seeing how it plays out. There are power brokers out there who, you know, and I'm speaking on a highly conspiratorial level here. This might sound a little bit wacky to some people in your audience, but you know, there's people out there in positions of power that are willing to do things like this. You know, is this just a theory? Is this really going on? I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, history tells us that it's possible, and whether it is or not, I don't know. But you know, I know there's people out there that espouse evil, and I don't think they're sitting idly by. Are they a part of everything we're seeing, all this chaos we're seeing on television? I don't know. I can't say for sure, but I certainly think that it would be a way for them to further their goals.
Does Hitler have any living relatives left?
According to the research that Gerard has done, yes. Well, you talking about direct descendants or blood relatives just at all?
Yeah, just at all. Like, you know, they talk about it.
Oh yeah. Oh yes.
Yeah.
Yes, he does have blood relatives. If you watch the documentary Meet the Hitlers. There's actually one individual who claims to be, and there's some question about whether he is or not, but the reason that question arose as to whether he was or not, was they contacted somebody who legitimately they knew was a blood relative of Hitler, who said, no, I don't think that guy's related to us. I believe, and I could be wrong. I'm sure you have audience members who've seen it, and I might be not remembering it correctly, but unless I'm thinking of something just totally out of left field, I'm fairly certain that yes, he has some living blood relatives. And there are theories out there, as I said, that Hitler and Eva Braun had one or two daughters, and that his line was on.
Yeah, I've heard that rumor. I just wasn't sure if you guys had any contact with anybody throughout the investigation.
No, that's that's been a point that we certainly have encountered individuals that related to other folks, both last season and this season. We uncover some family members of some very well-known and high-ranking individuals, but as far as access to anyone directly related to Adolf Hitler himself, those who are living and known to be living have, you know, for obvious reasons, chosen to distance themselves from that, and they have wanted privacy from that and have chose to seclude themselves. I think many of them have actually changed their surname. I've never had a conversation with Gerard as far as, you know, what he's done to run down the possibility of talking to Hitler's actual descendants, if he has any. So, but, you know, for obvious reasons, those are people that would want to keep that secret. If they are out there, maybe in a couple of generations that will change. You know, we've certainly seen that in the past, that generations down the line come forward and they say, you know, this is a horrible family secret we've been hiding, and I think the only way to cleanse our familial soul is basically to come forward with this information. So, you know, maybe someday we'll see that.
Now, Mike, let me get just a little bit wordy here, because that's what I do. you know, in order to spare us Jews, God spread us to the four winds of the earth. You know, he created a diaspora. Mm-hmm. And throughout the Hunting Hitler investigation, it seems to have focused primarily in South America for obvious reasons. Do you think that your investigation is eventually going to send you to other countries? I mean, would they have gone to other countries as well as South America?
I do. I think at the time, if you look at the mid 20th century and on, South America was an ideal location for them because of the bridges that they had built leading up and during the Second World War. That was an area of the world that didn't have a lot of focus on it. Had a lot of remote areas. This was before, you know, this was pre-internet, pre-iPhone, pre-YouTube, so this was an ideal place for him. But I think, and we touched on it very briefly in second season, and you'll see something of it here in the third season, that as friendly governments, we're talking about a very tumultuous time in the continent of South America when governments were falling at a fairly prolific rate, and you do see a migration of these escaped Nazis as these governments are changing hands from a friendly government to a not-so-friendly government. So we know that there was some movement there. I have to think that over a certain amount of time, it would have made sense for them to move out of there and to other locations, including the U.S., because, you know, obviously, post-World War II, as the eyes were on us, as we were emerging as a superpower, especially when you're talking about these second-generation individuals who wouldn't be recognizable and, you know, had a birth certificate from wherever it might be, they could very easily come to the U.S., using what was left of this Nazi plunder to set themselves up and set up a foothold and possibly continue with the plans for this Fourth Reich, Fifth Reich, whatever it might be. So I do think there was some of that. You know, obviously the key to our investigation is these individuals, you know, Adolf Hitler himself and his close confidants. So we're just concentrating on that. We have gotten some leads that would possibly take us in other directions. We couldn't, some of them came a little bit late this year, so we couldn't necessarily run them down. We know about them. Will there be a fourth season? I don't know. I can tell you that we're still getting information, so if there is a fourth season, I think you would certainly see us flexing outside of South America, going to some other locations, if that were to happen. If not, I mean, we've got the information, and, you know, this could always get passed off to someone else. This could make a standalone documentary someday, or this could be something that somebody runs down on their own and ends up on the front page of every magazine in the world someday. Who knows?
Just one more reason that we need to build that wall, right?
I think Canada.
They'd probably already be on this side of the wall. I'm a Texan, so I'm in favor of the wall, and I actually know quite a few Border Patrol agents, and I actually work with quite a few of them because the company that Tim and I have, Sheepdog, and literally. It kind of funny, we're kind of doing an odd segue here, but watching the meeting in the White House last week, and Henry Cuellar, who's from South Texas, who has quite a reputation in Texas, I can tell you, trying to tell Trump that none of the Border Patrol chiefs or agents believe the wall will work. And every Border Patrol agent I know saying that he's completely full of it. That's not the case. You know, we do need some physical barriers. We need 21st century barriers. You can't build a wall across the entire border. Geography won't allow it. And just a wall is not what you need because anybody can climb over a wall. So we need a combination of physical barriers and electronic surveillance and agents on the ground patrolling it and agents allowed to do their job. We need a complete revamp of that system. This is totally outside the scope of this show, but
I mean, we can't get that done here.
Yeah, no, I don't think so. Hopefully they'll get it done in D.C. this year. I've got a little bit of hope for that. So we need. We know that what we have now is just not working. So we need something.
Yeah. Well, you know. And we have to keep an eye out on those Canadians too, right? You know, especially with the Nazis.
Yeah, you know, trying to come down here and you know spread hockey everywhere.
Yeah, how rude! They're just too nice. We're going to have to do something about that.
Yeah, the
Leafs.
Yeah, change that politeness. Well, I'll tell you, it's been interesting. It's certainly a great series that you guys are a part of, and I'm glad you're back for another season. And hopefully a fourth one comes along. We love watching it. And again, we thank you for being on the show. And we've had our guest today has been Dr. Michael Simpson. Thank you.
Thank you very much, guys. Thank you for having me on. I hope everybody enjoys the show.
Oh, awesome. It's been a pleasure.
To find out more about our show, guests, or listen to a previous show, visit our website at www.somethingweirdmedia.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.